So welcome to this morning's talk. In the interviews and also some of the questions we've had in the last couple of nights, people have asked again about how insight happens in this path of meditation, which I've been teaching here the last few days. And I've often said that the insight happens automatically. You don't have to go looking for insight. And there is no difference between Samatha, Vipassana, they all go together. But in order to make it more clear to you, so you get a better understanding of how all this works, and how by practicing in this path, you do get powerful, enlightening insights into the nature of your mind and your body, I'd like to introduce an old story, but it's a very good simile of how stillness gives rise to insight. And that is the story of Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia, where I live. And that monastery is on top of a hill. Those people who have been there know you go up a quite a steep hill for just over 2 kilometers, and at the top you find Bodhinyana Monastery. And you may also know that in the early years when we were very poor, I had to physically build that monastery. And even though I know some people say that according to history, that we've never shed blood to build and promote and spread Buddhism in this world, and no blood has been shed in the spreading of Buddhism, that is not true. I've shed much blood building Bodhinyana Monastery, hitting my hand with the hammer, sometimes catching the drill and hitting my head. So many of those buildings have got my DNA on it, my blood. So blood has been shed to build Buddhism in Western Australia, at least. But living there for so many years, it's over 26 years now I've been in that monastery, and it was maybe about 7 or 8 years after I began living in that monastery that one day, coming back from an appointment in Perth, we were very early, it was about an hour and a half to lunch, it was a wonderful, beautiful spring morning, so I asked the driver of the car in which I was travelling, please let me out at the bottom of the hill, I want to walk up. One, for exercise, and two, because it was a beautiful morning. So the driver let me out and carried on up the hill by himself, and I had a leisurely walk up the hillside. What happened next became a great simile for how insight occurs. Because as I was walking up the hillside, I was struck by the fact I could not recognize my surroundings. The hillside looked very different than I remembered seeing through the window of a car. And that was weird, because I've been living in that monastery over 8 years, and I've been up and down that hill in a vehicle looking out the window maybe at least 2 or 3 times each week. And how come after 8 years I was seeing that hillside as if for the first time? And that was such a surprise to me that I stood absolutely still. I stopped walking. And as I looked, without moving at all, the hillside changed again. When I was standing absolutely still, I began to see lichen on the rocks, little flowers and bushes hidden amongst the grass, beautiful patterns on the barks of the trees. I saw so much more, and what I saw when I stood still became even more beautiful than I could ever remember seeing. It was delightful. Now that was such a striking experience that after I had enjoyed the scenery for a while and started walking up the hill, I wondered, what on earth is going on? How come I've never noticed all that beauty or the details or the wonderful colors before? And as I started contemplating, because I was trained in science and I knew a little bit about biology, I started to realize that when you're watching scenery from the inside of a speeding car, the light which hits the back of your eye, the retina, does not have enough time to form a proper image. And if you're looking through the window of a car, before it forms a full image in the back of your eye, that light is dislodged by the next image, and then the next image, and then the next image. Because the chemical reaction required to form an image on the back of your eye never has time to fully form. It means you don't see much of what's out there. And also, the colors aren't fully formed either. They're pale, washed out. It's just chemistry. But when you go slower, when you walk and watch, then your eye has more time. A more detailed and richer picture is formed on the back of your eye, and your brain has more time to investigate it. So when you walk, you see more, and even the colors are richer. But nothing beats standing still and just gazing. Because when you stand perfectly still and just watch something, only then does that image on the back of your eye fully form with all of the details. But even more importantly, the image forms with the 100% richness of color which was out there before, but which, when you're looking through a window of a speeding car, never fully forms. And that was precisely explained the experience I just had. Because the slower I went, the more detail I saw, the different textures on the rocks, all the amazing little flowers which were on that hillside. And what really struck me, and struck many people, when you are slow like that, the colors are richer and deeper. The grass never looks so green. The water never so blue. You saw so much more. It was richer, and because of its richness and detail, it became incredibly beautiful. And from that experience I realized, this is just seeing with the eyes. Smelling, tasting, touching, hearing. Because we go so fast in life, because it is as if we're seeing, tasting, touching life as if through the window of a speeding vehicle. That's why we miss so much. Sounds, smells, tastes, touches are never fully formed. We never give them the time to fully form. And our mind doesn't have the chance to fully explore it before we go on to something else. But when you go slow, when the mind starts to slow down and even come to a stop, then all the senses can fully know what's out there. Not only do you know what's out there, but what you experience is richer and surprisingly far more beautiful and delightful. And your mind has a time to investigate it and to get to know it. Now you may know why I said earlier on that if you meditate and your mind becomes still, the food which you eat at breakfast and lunch becomes more delicious than ever before. It is exactly the same type of food, but because your mind is going slow, you're picking up more of the taste, and the taste is fully forming in your mouth, and your mind has more chance to investigate it. Or if you're listening to sound, the sound of the birds is louder because you hear more of it, and it's more rich. You can see more of the modulations and changes of tone. Because your mind is slowing down, you can know more and what you know is more delightful. Now you may know what is happening to you when you get into that stage of meditation, which I call the delightful breath. Because you're slowing down, you can see much, much more of this process we call breathing. And what you see and experience becomes more delightful. You're sitting there and just having fun, just watching the breath go in and go out. If you are, as it were, running around, the breath is boring, just like my hillside. But when you slow down, it becomes incredibly beautiful. Now this stage, when you get to say the delightful breath, is showing that you're slowing down. The sign that your mindfulness is slowing down is that you start to feel delight in whatever you do and whatever happens. At this stage, it's not just watching the breath becomes delightful, it's just watching the trees is delightful. Hearing the sound of the birds is delightful. Everything becomes beautiful and delightful. And then you might appreciate the following story, which has not just happened to me, but happened to many meditators when you get to this stage of meditation. I remember having a very beautiful meditation. My mind was so still, and everything I looked at, everything I heard was incredibly delightful and full of happiness and bliss. But I had to go to the toilet. So I went on to the toilet, and just before I flushed the chain, I happened to look in the toilet bowl. Wow! Look at that! I've never seen such a beautiful piece of shit in my life. Look at the browns and the shape of it. It was just so beautifully contoured, and it glistened in the water. And the smell was so fragrant. I've never experienced such a beautiful smell before. And I was gazing at that toilet bowl, I don't know for how long. If someone had seen me, they'd have taken me away, thinking I was crazy. But that's nature. Because whatever you look at and see becomes incredibly beautiful and fragrant. That's a sign your mindfulness is getting very, very strong. That you're getting insights, because you can see deeper in to what you're experiencing than ever before. So if you want to develop insight, you have to develop a mind which can see so much detail, to see every contour of the rocks in the hillside, to see the beautiful colours there. Not only does it give you a sense of delight, the delight can keep you there long enough for insight to do its work. And this is where you start to understand things. So that's why I keep on saying that getting to that delightful breath, that is what I call the pivot point of meditation. That is a turning point. If you can get to that stage, then off you go. Insights will come, understandings will arise, you want to meditate, and you're away. You find out all your insights which you possibly could want. Now, of course, I did mention, I think in the 2 days ago, that when we do this meditation, we also get insights, what I say, insights into the path. And how to get more still, how to get more peaceful. Because in your meditation, you will come across what I call blockages. You get so far and you can't go deeper. Now this is the cold face of insight. This is where insight happens. This is not theory. You're faced with an attachment. Something which you are holding on to, which stops you going deeper. Now this is where the only way to go past that blockage is to get that insight. What on earth am I holding on to? Why can't I let this go? Why am I so afraid? All fear is an attachment about to go and disappear. something you cling on to is being taken away from you, is being threatened. And that is called fear. So every time fear comes up in your meditation, that is an invitation to insight. You're about to see an attachment. Now, this is not attachments in theory. This is attachments in practice. Many people come and tell me, I'm not attached to my body. I've been practicing Buddhism for many years. I'm not afraid of dying. And then they go to the doctor, they say they've got cancer. Ah! And they come and see me. I've got cancer. Do something about it. I don't want to die. I'm too young to die. I'm only 80. That actually was true. There was a story of this lady, 96 years of age, in the United States. She was 96. She never had a day of sickness in her life. She must have had incredible good karma from a past life, and this life too. 96 years, perfectly healthy. And then she went to the doctor to have a test, an examination, and the doctor found a cancer. And she was devastated. When she came out of hospital, she said, why me? 96 years of age, she got away with it. And now, after 96 years, she got upset that she had cancer. I think she did pretty well. But a lot of people, you think you understand death. You think you're not attached to your body. But the only time you find out is when it's threatened, when you are about to die. Let alone your body. What about all the other things you're attached to? All your possessions. Sometimes you think, I'm a Buddhist, I don't care about possessions. But what happens when the burglar comes into your room and steals your telephone? This happened to one of my disciples over in Perth. He was a really good man. He didn't have many possessions. He wasn't married. He was a good meditator. The only possession he had of any worth was his Harley Davidson motorbike. It was worth about 50 grand. This is Australian dollars. That's a lot of money. Because those motorbikes, I don't know if they're collector's items or what, but they are very, very expensive. Now, you could buy a sort of a great new car for one of those motorbikes. So he had the only possession he really cared about was his Harley motorbike. And he said one day he went to the shopping mall, parked it in the multi-story car park, went to do his shopping, and when he came back, he found it was stolen. Because they're very easy to steal, motorbikes. You can just, if you've got a couple of strong guys, you can lift it up and put it in the back of a van. And the one thing he really cared about, the only valuable possession he had been stolen. And as he looked at the empty spot, he thought, anicca, impermanent. And he was so proud of himself. Only when it was stolen did he realize, yes, he was not attached to it. And he was just patting himself on the back, smiling. He said, Ajahn Bhan will be very proud of me. The only thing which I own, I'm not attached to. And as he was feeling so good about himself, that's when he realized he was on the wrong level of the car park. He went to the correct level. His bike was still there. So it was win-win for him. He still had his motorbike, but he had tested himself, and he passed. He wasn't attached. So sometimes we can think we have an insight into attachment, but it's only when it's challenged do we really know for sure. And that's why when you get to these stages of meditation, that's when you're challenged. When your body starts to disappear, are you attached to your body or not? If you can't let it go, in other words, if the nimitta can't arise because you're still holding on to your body, it means you are attached to this body. And it means that when you are told you've got cancer, you will be worried. When it's the time for you to die, you will struggle. You haven't passed that test yet. You haven't got enough insight into the nature of this body to be able to let it go. So in this type of meditation, you are given tests to find out whether you understand the nature of this body or not. Which means if you can let it go, you can get to nirvana, and the body is, don't know where it is, you can't feel your legs, your hands, your back, your head, no, you can't see anything, you can't hear anything, you're totally inside, well done, you've gone over one attachment, at least this time. It means when you die, it's very easy for you to let go of your body then as well. So when we say in Buddhism, you're attached to your body, this is actually what you find it feels like. And so you investigate these things. You come across these tests, and you keep on contemplating, letting go, experiencing, until you can let go of this body. Until you realize, what am I afraid of? Why should I hang on to this very heavy body? It's much more fun when I let it go and go into these beautiful, peaceful meditation states. But at least you're discovering what the attachment is. Even earlier on, your attachment to thinking. That is an attachment. Why do you always have to think and give your opinion on things? Isn't it much better to say, I don't know, not my problem, and just be quiet inside? For those of you who have lots of worries, for those of you who have lots of personal problems, this is one of the greatest stories from my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. This was the story of the ex-British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, who during the Six-Day War in 1968 or something, when Israel was fighting a war against Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan, there was this huge battle in the Middle East. And this Prime Minister was interviewed by the newspapers. Prime Minister, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? And the Prime Minister replied, Sir, there is no problem in the Middle East. What do you mean? Said the journalist. There is a war going on right now. As we speak, people are getting blown up by tank shells. They're having their bodies cut into pieces by bullets. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? There's a war going on. And very calmly, this great statesman replied, Sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it is not a problem. Now that is brilliant. That's Buddhist. Because why do we worry so much about things which we can't do anything about? We're wasting our time. We're wasting our peace and our freedom on things which aren't problems. If it has got a solution, fine, think about it. If there is no solution, it's not a problem. I'm going to just meditate instead. Now, if you understand that, you can understand it's logical, it's reasonable. But why can't we let go of our thinking when we know it's getting us nowhere? Attachment again. Because you know one of the reasons why. What attachment really is this is what we think we are. This is what we think we own. This is how we identify ourselves. I am my thinking. I am my thoughts. This is my personal possession. No one can interfere with my thoughts. They're mine. After a while of meditating, after a while of messing around with this thinking mind which never gets you anywhere, which stops you getting peaceful, after a while you recognize these thoughts suck.
All these thoughts which go on in my head, and they just take me away from something more beautiful, the peace and the wisdom, the discernment. So after a while you realize thinking is dukkha. And it's most of it is useless. So when you realize that, then you can let it go. And you know you can let it go when you pass the test, which is to be able to sit in meditation without a thought going on in your mind. And if a thought comes up, it just disappears again. The reason you are thinking is because you are attached to your thoughts. No other reason. So you're getting the insight now of your attachment to thinking. And you're also finding out how to overcome that attachment. How to let go. And you feel what letting go is. So on this path, you've already seen attachment to the body, attachment to thinking, and what letting go really means. And part of that letting go, which I was talking about yesterday, is this beautiful contentment. Not expecting anything, not wanting anything, but just letting go of all craving and all wanting and all desire. And some of you do that when you're just happy to be here with this crazy mind, with this old aching body. I'm just happy to be here. This is good enough for me. When you have that degree of contentment, you find you do let go. And with it goes all your attachments. You're finding out what this letting go truly is. You're understanding, as I said yesterday, what this third noble truth is of letting go. Now, of course, I started off this talk by saying there's no difference between insight meditation and calm meditation. They all go together. But nevertheless, I do teach there are two types of meditation. There are two types of meditation, and this is not samatha vipassana. That's not what I mean. I like to tell people the two types of meditation are second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. What do I mean by second noble truth meditation? What is the second noble truth? Second noble truth, which many of you should know, craving leads to suffering. That's called second noble truth. So second noble truth meditation is, I want to be peaceful, I want nimittas, I want jhanas, I want these beautiful lights, I want to be enlightened. That's craving. And what does craving produce? Suffering, yeah. So if you're suffering in this meditation, if you're getting frustrated and disappointment that you're not getting as far as you intended to, if you're really upset, you have been doing second noble truth meditation. Even in this meditation, if you're suffering, suffering means you've been craving. So in the next meditation you do, if you're not happy and at peace, there is a cause. Suffering comes from craving. So your meditation, when it's not working, that means you're investigating the second noble truth. It's still worthwhile. There's no such thing as a bad meditation. When you get frustrated, when it doesn't go the way you want it to, when you get upset and dull and you're really upset because you can't get peaceful, well done. You have just been contemplating the second noble truth. So don't need to contemplate it too much. Get the insight. If you're suffering, you've been craving. So stop craving. So that's the first type of meditation. Second noble truth meditation. And unfortunately, that's what most people do. Want, suffer, suffer, suffer. And they can never get the smiley, happy meditations. So the other meditation is third noble truth meditation. Just let go. I'm slow, I'm slothful, I'm torpid, fine. I'm restless, great. Nothing happens, I just get stuck in just the present moment of awareness, can't get even to the breath, fine. Let go of craving. Yeah, you get a nimitta, you can't take it further. Wonderful, great, no desire, no craving, contentment, happy to be here, wherever that happens to be, whether I'm in a prison or in a monastery or Mahindarama temple or in a spa on the beach. Fine, I'm just content to be here. That's called Third Noble Truth Meditation. Now where does non-craving lead to? Enlightenment, Nibbana. So do you get the point now? When you meditate and you feel really peaceful and very happy, it doesn't matter what stage you're in, you feel very peaceful and very happy because you've got no craving. Now you've understood the third noble truth. You've got insight into the two main noble truths, number two and number three. So all the time you've been meditating here, the good meditations, you have been learning what the third noble truth means. The bad meditations, you've been learning the second noble truth. Each one, you're gaining insight. Each one, you're learning the core teaching of the Buddha. But as you go deeper, as you go deeper and you learn how to let go of the attachment to the body, learn how to let go of the attachment to the thoughts, you get these lights coming up in your mind. And those of you who've got these lights coming up in your mind, there's another attachment you have to let go of. Now these are the more refined attachments, even more refined than the attachment to your body. And this is called the attachment to control. You are all control freaks. Some of you are big control freaks. Some of you are middle control freaks. Some of you are little control freaks. But only enlightened ones are not control freaks at all. Because when you have this nimitta, wonderful, you're getting a beautiful meditation. And what do? They try and control it. They try and hold it, keep it, change it. Say, what should I do next? It's all controlling. And you will find there's a huge examination at this stage. And only if you pass that exam can you go on to the next stage of jhanas. And that is to totally let go of control. You really have, as I said to many of you, take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedal, and just freewheel. And don't interfere at all. Because even the slightest interference, and the nimitta starts to shake and disappear. But if you learn how to do absolutely nothing, to let go of all of this controlling, totally, 100%, to be able to sit there and just watch without giving any orders at all. In other words, to let go 100% of your will, then that nimitta becomes still, you just fall in. This is natural, it has to happen. The obstacle is you. Your will. This is the last abandoning of your craving. You all have heard the Buddha said that even the will is not me, not mine, not a self. For those of you who have studied the suttas, one of the greatest teachings of the Buddha was the second sermon, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the teaching on non-self. I say that's one of the greatest suttas because that created the first five enlightened ones, arahats, after the Buddha. The first sermon, Dhammacakka, created the first stream winner. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta just hit them with non-self, and the five first disciples became fully enlightened. That was a very powerful teaching. You know what that starts off with? Now the five khandhas, body, feeling, perception, mental formations, which includes will and consciousness, they don't belong to me. And the Buddha said, if they did belong to me, I could tell them, consciousness, be like this, be like that.
mental formations, please be like this, be like that. If they belong to you, they would succumb to your will. But the Buddha said they don't belong to you, therefore you can't do that. You can't tell anything to be anything. You tell your consciousness to do this, you tell your mind to do that, it won't. Why? Because it doesn't belong to you. How many of you have been telling your mind to meditate? How many of you have been telling your mind to be still? Can you do it? No. This is directly the teaching of the Buddha in the second sermon. You can't control your mind, your consciousness, your Vedana perception, mental formations. You can't even control your body. Why? Because it doesn't belong to you. So if you realize that, if you fully penetrate that with insight, I'm out of control. It's wonderful. I think I saw somebody had a t-shirt with one of my sayings on. I saw it yesterday. Don't worry, everything's out of control. Ajahn Brahm. You've got it, have you? Is it on your back now? Okay, I saw someone with it. That's a great saying. Stop worrying, everything's out of control anyway, so just let go, you can't do anything. When you realize that, the result of that is not just everything gets more chaotic. When you realize that teaching, it means you stop trying to control things. You let go. You get the insight into all that controlling and will is not coming from you. It's not your slave, but it's your master. All of you probably assume that your will is your servant. In other words, you can bend the will to get what you want, to satisfy you. You think it's your servant, your maid. But it is your master and mistress. Once you actually see what the will truly is, you think, I don't want to have anything to do with this again. I always thought it was my friend. It was my worker. The will was going to be providing me with happiness, fulfillment, whatever I wanted if I could train it properly. And now you realize this thing which you cherished and thought you had under your thumb is totally out of control and causing you such misery and suffering. If you see that, it's so easy to let go of the will. And this is a test you have. You use all of that contemplation, that external understanding, to take this last jump of faith at first. And when you see that nimitta, totally let go. Let go of all will, all control, all choice, all deciding on where you want to go and when you want to go. When you do that, you let go big time, that's when you get the jhanas. These beautiful states which teach you, wow, this is peace, this is pleasure, this is profound. And this is the prize for letting go. And then you get the insight very, very clear. Yeah, what the Buddha said is absolutely true. This will is suffering. It's dukkha. So push it aside. Stop controlling. It just creates more of a mess rather than cleaning up messes. And then you get into these wonderful jhanas. So you get these insights on the way. They're real insights because they're a test. Just the same when I was a school teacher, I had to set examinations in maths. And I was told and I learned that the best test, you realize you got it at the right level, if maybe sort of one person got 90%, most of them got about between 50 and 70%, and only a few got under 50%. If everybody got over 90%, that was a test too easy. If everyone got under 50%, that was just too hard. Because the purpose of a test was actually to find out
whether your students had really understood, and find out what they hadn't understood. So you always had to set a test where no one got a perfect score. Most of them got about 70, 50, 60, 70, 80%, and hardly anyone sort of was under 50%, and that was what we were trying to aim for. And the same in these meditations, we're testing you, and if you pass that test, of course you get the prize, incredible jhanas, because then you've learned and understood what these attachments are, what stops you being free. Before, you'd always think that the body is something I can control, I'm in charge of, and if I look after it and care for it and always watch it, I'm going to be happy. What ends up, you just get old and sick and die. You think thinking is a wonderful skill to develop and cherish. And if I really learn how to think clearly, positively, then I'm going to be happy. And after a while, it still creates you turmoil. Until you learn, if I let go of thinking, it becomes silent. Wow, now that is happy. And that's actually where you learn. You get wisdom from silence, much more than from thinking. The great sages are not the great thinkers. They are the silent ones. They're the great sages. And to let go of will and control, that's one of the hardest. That is what you have to let go of to get into the jhanas. So you're tested. And I've got enough confidence in you that I've given you some of the toughest tests. Some of you will pass. You'll be able to let go of will. And you go into incredibly beautiful states. And when you come out afterwards, you reflect and say, wow, this was actually true. You really have gained insight, not from thinking, but from experience. Which is why you don't just decide, I'm going to do insight. This insight comes with the meditation you're doing. It's part and parcel of it. Now there is even deeper insights, and I mentioned these in an earlier talk, and these are the powerful ones which will make you stream winners, once returners, non-returners and arahats. For a long time now, I've taught to the very highest and deepest levels. When I started teaching, people said, look, you're wasting your time, Ajahn Brahm, teaching lay people about jhanas. They will never do it. And I even talking to a Vietnamese disciple, and they said in some parts of Vietnam, they have stopped teaching jhanas. They've banned it because they thought it's just too much for their laity. They just teach it to monks and nuns. To me, I think that's unfair. So I think that even the Buddha said he does not teach with a closed fist. He just opens up to everybody, whoever wants to learn. And so I teach all the way to jhanas, and some of you manage to do it. Wonderful, it works. But also to teach the highest of those insights and how they work. And I mentioned this in brief in a previous talk. When you come out of these jhana states, you have such a powerful mind. It's just like you've been supercharged. Which is why you will not be able to go to sleep. You've just got too much energy. You don't need to sleep. You're bright, happy, and someone can come up to you and say you're a stupid idiot. They can swear at you and say, girl, you've got a face like a camel. Or whatever. And it just, no way can they make you angry. They can give you the worst abuse, even swear at you and be crude to you. But because your mind is just so bright and beautiful, nothing can make you upset or angry. That's a sign your hindrances are totally abandoned for a long period of time. And if the most beautiful guy, the hottest chick, came into your room totally naked, you would just flesh, that's all. You would have no lust whatsoever, because you're just blissed out and peaceful. The hindrances just can't come. You're that poised. And this is the time when you get the powerful insights. Not only is your mind powerful and still, But it's just come out of one of the most amazing experiences of your life. Sorry, the most amazing experience of your life. Because there's nothing beats it in intensity and profundity, the experience of a jhana. And it's automatic. I can't see how this cannot happen. It doesn't make any sense to me that it wouldn't happen. That once you've come out of a jhana, you look back and say, what was that? Wow, that was amazing. What was that? What was going on? My job as a teacher is to encourage that even more. Look at those experiences. And in particular, don't look at those experiences and say, what were they? But look at those experiences and ask the question, what was missing? Understand those experiences, not by what's there, but by what is not there. Because that is the most fruitful way of getting the deep insights which leads to enlightenment. And this is where I was alluding to a few minutes ago, to the simile of the tadpole. Tadpole, born in water, grown up in water, lived all its life in water, will not be able to understand what water is. Cannot do so. A fish will never understand water. The thing with a tadpole though, the reason I use the tadpole rather than a fish, is because one day the tadpole grows legs and transforms into a frog, and once it's a frog, it can jump out of the lake. So you are fortunate, you're human beings. You're not just tadpoles, you're growing the legs to become jhana frogs. So you can jump out of this reality of your body and five senses into the jhana experience. That's like the frog jumping out of the lake onto dry land. Once the frog jumps onto dry land, you can imagine what it's like. The frog has been in the water as long as it's known, and now it's on a very strange place. Nothing like it has been experienced before. This is really weird and strange. It can't swim. There's no water around it. For the first time the frog stands on dry land, it is really amazing. This is weird. And the frog will understand that experience by what's missing. Water. And once the frog understands that, ah, that's what water was. This thing which had been all around me ever since I knew, and now it's gone. That's what water is. This is the first time the frog can get insight into the nature of water. Beforehand, it's not insight. It can think about water. It can read about water. It can go to Abhidharma classes on water. But it won't really understand what water is until it's jumped out of the lake. And where water's not there, now it can know what water was. Now that's the simile, the best I can give you, for what happens, number one, when you even get into nimittas. Real full-blown lights, where you can't hear anything, where you can't feel your body, is an incredibly beautiful light, and someone can actually shout at you, hey, it's lunchtime, and you just will not hear them. Now that degree of nimitta is where something is missing, your body and five senses. And for those of you who think you understand your body, you understand what these five senses are, you're just like the tadpole thinks they understand water. When your body really disappears and is beyond you, you can't touch it, you can't feel it, you can't hear it, now you have an opportunity to know what this body is. And one of the first things which you usually understand is just what a pain this body is. Even when you're healthy, even when you're rested, even when you're well fed, even when you're on a holiday at a beautiful beach, even when you're having sex, even all those occasions, the body is a pain. Because now you've got something to compare it to. When the body is totally absent, you're there, this is so free. As I said earlier, it's better than sex. The reason I mention that is because many people, that's the most pleasurable, delightful experience they've known so far in their life. And now, the body's disappearing, this is much, much better. Now you can understand from that what we mean by the body being suffering. When monks say that, some people think, oh, you monks are crazy. You monks want to get a real life. You monks, especially, some monks have never had relationships before. They go and become a monk when they're very young, they haven't had sex. I was fortunate in that sense. I had an experience of the world, had girlfriends, had sex, had orgasms. So, I don't mind talking about this, it's real life. And I've also had deep meditation as well. And when you compare the two, forget about sex. Deep meditation is far more fun, lasts longer and deeper than any orgasm. And I'm speaking from experience. So when people say you monks are weird, I have to come and tell them those experiences which I had, so people actually take me seriously, until you find out those experiences yourself. So when the Buddha said the body is suffering, yeah, it is. All of it. So, when you realize that, bye-bye body. I'm not really interested in you anymore. I've got something much better. You've gone out of your body, beyond your body. I don't mean astral travel, because I said the other night, that's making another body. Still, it's very blissful, but nowhere near as blissful as the jhanas. So, what does it mean not being attached to your body? What it really means in practice is you're not afraid of death at all. The doctor comes and says you're going to die, right, the chief reverend, yeah, ha ha ha, great, at last, thank you very much. Sooner the better. And you're not afraid when other people die as well. Yeah, they're just going to let go of all their suffering. Mum, hurry up, it's good, I know. Don't hang around, come on, die, 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 die. And you're doing that out of love for your mother. Because you know something which other people don't know. Now, also, as you go into the jhanas proper, especially into the second jhana, that is brilliant. Because in that one, there is something missing which stands out so clearly. And of course, that is totally the absence of will. In the first jhana, I call it a wobble. That's just experiential term. Yeah, you've given up the will, but it still has its echoes left. The mind is not totally still, but in the second jhana, it's rock. It's like diamond. Nothing moves at all. I can describe that. You may get some sort of idea, but you will never really know what I mean until you get into that second jhana and notice how still stillness can be. This is perfect stillness. And you're not doing it. You can't hold things still. As I said, with a cup of water, you can't hold it still. You've let it down, and now it's not moving at all. What's missing is not the movement, but the cause of the movement, which is your will, your choice, your doing. And this is actually where you fully understand the nature of chetana, will, the one thing which is so personal to you. At least you have the choice whether to sit down here or go outside if you don't like it. Sure, you've joined up for this retreat, but you've got the choice to leave whenever you want. You've got the choice to go to the toilet. Sure, you've only got a certain amount of food given for lunch, but at least you've got the choice to take it or leave it. If you don't like it, you can go outside. There's plenty of hawker stalls down the road. You can buy something more delicious. You have choice. And even when you sit down, at least you've got a choice whether you can do metta meditation, breath meditation, or just fantasize and go to sleep. You've got that choice. What happens if you don't have any choice whatsoever? that all the levers of control are totally out of your reach. It's not just taking your hand off the steering wheel and feet off the pedals. It's like taking that steering wheel and throwing it out of the window of the car. It's actually unscrewing the pedals and throwing them out the back window. So you're driving a car with no steering wheel and no pedals. That's what it's like. It's totally gone, the wheel. And only at this point you realize what this wheel truly was. It wasn't yours. It wasn't part of you. It didn't define you. It was just a part of nature, which until you understood what it was, it masqueraded as your friend and servant. Now you see it as your enemy number one, your master, always pushing you around, making you do things, making you sort of, okay, come on, meditate with effort now. Come on, do it properly. There's only a day and a half to go, says Will. Come on, don't mess around. No more sleep, no more messing around, says Will. Meditate really long hours. Don't go to sleep tonight. It's your last day of the retreat. That's what Will does. Don't believe it. It's pushing you around. That is the enemy. That is what stops you becoming peaceful and enlightened. So even though it's the last day of the retreat, don't get sucked in to Will telling you, meditate harder, it's the last day. Carry on as you've been doing all along. Let go, make peace, be calm, be gentle, be kind. That goes against the will. That is what we really need to do to get peaceful. But these are the insights you get. But my goodness, if you overcome that illusion of the will, you'll probably be an anagami if you see it properly. Because that lets go of all of this trying to do things. You're free. You're at peace. Sure, when you come out again, will is there, but you know exactly what it is. You tolerate it, but you never celebrate it anymore. And you never think it is yours. And the other thing which happens as you go deep into the jhanas is the other thing which starts to disappear is your consciousness. Your mind starts to vanish. It's like peeling an onion as you go from one jhana to the next. All these attributes you thought were essential to your consciousness starts to vanish. And you find even the consciousness is not mine. This happens not because you can think about it or reach it through inference or logic, but you see it vanishing. Only when you see it vanishing do you get the insight, this can't be me, nothing to do with me. And that gives you the final insight of full enlightenment. When this mind, this consciousness, the will, the body, none of it belongs to me, just a natural process. And when it disappears, it's happier and more peaceful. And the more solid these things are, the more suffering you have. These are insights which come from the experience of this path. The deeper you go, the clearer it is, just like walking up the road to my monastery, the slower you go, the more you see. And it's not a negative path, because the deeper you practice, the more these insights come up. People think, wow, this is terrifying. I'm not in charge, I'm not the knower. The point is that the more you see, the more delightful it becomes. It may be counterintuitive, thinking, my goodness, if I let go of all these things, I've become such a miserable person. No enjoyment left in life. That's why you have monks like me who come up here and have fun with you, to show where it's actually more fun the more you let go. It's more delightful. You have more happiness, more smile, more laughter. Just to show you've got nothing to be afraid of. As you let go of suffering and all the causes of suffering, you gain the insights into the nature of the mind. It gets happier and happier and happier. That's the nature of insight. So,
when people come up to me and say they have insight, I don't pay much attention to how they explain it. They may say the most profound of things and say, wow, that sounds deep. That is not the sign of insight. That's just a sign that they can think deeply and say weird and strange and profound things. The sign of insight is your state of inner freedom. And you can usually see that by how happy you are, especially in the difficult situations of life. So you find out how much a person understands when they're in difficulty, under stress, in turmoil, and just see how they handle it, whether they can take it all with a smile. Nothing to do with me, none of my business, who cares? That's how you find out if you have insight. So this morning I've given a talk on insight. And I've taken it from the ordinary levels to the very deepest of levels, as you deserve. If you don't understand all of this, don't worry, one day you will. If you understand a bit of it, that's good enough. But at least it gives you the map, so that what I've been teaching over the last few days can be put into the big picture. This is not just samatha, just to make you peaceful and give you a good time. This is 100% pure, straight down the line, teachings of the Buddha and how it works. So, best of luck. So, any questions on this morning's deep, powerful talk? Yeah. Can one know what stage of jhana when one enters a jhanic state? No. And can one decide when to come out of the jhanic state? Yes, but only in a strange way. First of all, when you're in those deep states of meditation, at the time you will have no width of comprehension to investigate where you are. It's only when you come out afterwards you think, my goodness, that was amazing, that was wonderful, that was, never experienced anything like that before. When I say you don't know where you are, your mindfulness is supercharged. It's not as if you're sleepy, you're really on the ball. But you're in a very narrow place, in a sense, you can't really understand where you are. But when you come out afterwards, then when the mind can move, you can take that experience, which is, I described it some time ago, like a trauma. You know, if you have like a car accident, sometimes you can't get it out of your head. At night time you keep dreaming of it, reliving it, because it's imprinted so much in your memory. A jhana is similar, only it's positive. It's such a strong experience, it has an indelible print in your memory. So you can actually ask yourself, what was that experience? And you can feel it, re-experience it. But now you can move because you're out of the jhana. And now you can ask the questions of what was happening there? What was I aware of? And this is where I say you ask the most important question, what was missing? What was different from this experience than ordinary experience? And that seems to be the best place where you can get the deep insights, by looking at what was missing, what had disappeared, what had vanished. So you experience it and find out exactly which jhana it was afterwards. And just as a tip for you, the first jhana experience is very, very wide, and so many, many things are first jhana. So that's why the first jhana is very hard to define. The second jhana is much more specific. So it's very easy to tell if it's a second jhana and above. The first jhana is much more difficult. And usually, for your own experience, it's only when you've had an experience of second jhana can you actually get an idea of the whole range of what can be first jhana. So you learn from many experiences what these jhanas are truly like. As a rule of thumb, though, if you can hear anything, it's not a jhana. If you can ask the question, is this first jhana, second or third jhana, it can't be a jhana. So if you say, is this a jhana, can't be.
So there's no thinking possible. You're too still for that. And number two, coming out of the jhanas, while you're in, you can't come out. So what usually happens is the amount of karmic energy, the energy of stillness, the energy of letting go, which you brought into that attainment, when that wears out, you come out. Just a natural process. However, for those who are very skillful, who know they're likely to get into a jhana, they can do the technique which is well known for meditators. Before you enter the jhana, or maybe just when you start meditating, you know it's likely to happen, you say, I will enter jhana for 30 minutes. Well, let's make it even more interesting. 27 minutes and 30 seconds. You say that. I will enter jhana for 27 minutes and 30 seconds. And you will enter for that time almost 5 or 10 seconds either side. It's amazing just how the mind in those states, you program it, and after 27 minutes and 30 seconds you come out again. So that way you can keep appointments. Next question. Yeah. So I didn't quite catch it. If you have an insight, because the fans are very loud, it muffles the sound. If you have an insight and you feel sadness, it means you can't let go. It really depends on what sadness that is. Sometimes it's a sadness to say, gee, all this time I was being deluded, thinking that, you know, having sex, getting money or whatever was going to lead me to something really worthwhile. Sometimes when you have insights, there is that type of sadness. I think, how stupid could I have been all those years and I didn't see it? So there can be like a little bit of negativity there. The story which comes to mind from the suttas was a story of a blind man. And in his village there arrived a merchant selling expensive cloth. And in the time of the Buddha that always came from Benares. So he's selling this expensive Benares cloth to all the villagers. And a blind man thought, yeah, I want some too, I've got some money. So he went up to the merchant and said, can I have a Benares cloth too? He said, well, I've got one piece left, but it's very expensive. He said, I'll take it. So he paid a lot of money for this beautiful piece of Benares cloth. And he was so proud of his Benares cloth. But of course he couldn't see there was a dirty, oily rag the merchant had sold him. Because the merchant thought, this guy can't see, he doesn't know a fine cloth from an oily rag. So he sold him the oily rag. He'd done fraud. And later on, a doctor came to that village and looked at that blind man and said, I've got a special medicine, will cure your sight. And he applied the medicine and the blind man could see. And he looked at this cloth, this dirty old rag, this scallywag merchant had sold him. And he was very upset. I've been deluded for all this time. And that was a symbol the Buddha gave when you get insight. It's like you've been sold a dirty old rag by Mara. And when you actually see that and think, gee, all these years, you know, I've been pursuing happiness here and there and thinking how wonderful it is to be a human being, to be rich, to be wealthy, to be fit, to be healthy. And you've been sold a dirty old rag. And a monk comes along and gives you insight and you think, wow, all these years I've been frauded. So maybe you are sad. Depends what type of sadness. Okay. Okay, last question and we have interviews. Yep. Okay, now, after you can't become enlightened within a jhana, this is where you get all of the causes in place. So this is where jhana is made. This is where enlightenment is made. Jhana is like the kitchen in which the food of enlightenment is prepared. And only when you come out of the kitchen
into the dining room, do you eat it and get enlightened? So the jhana is the kitchen. And can you die in jhana, would you say? It's the only way you can die in jhana, as I said last night, it seems from anecdotal evidence that people in jhana become invulnerable. They can't be murdered or burnt. But I'm sure it does happen that sometimes your life faculty expires while you're in jhanas. So yeah, you can die in jhana. In my office, I've got a picture of a monk who was found in a cave in the north of Thailand, sitting in a perfect meditation posture, you know, with his legs crossed, his hands above one on top of the other, back perfectly straight, just a skeleton, with fragments of robe around him. Basically, he died in meditation. And when they discovered that monk in the cave, they asked the local head monks, and they know of no monk in their lifetime like that in the cave. So that monk was in that cave over 100 years probably, and there he died in meditation. And I got that picture in my room because I love that picture. Now that was probably, almost certainly, a monk who died in jhanas. Now if you die in the jhanas, there's two possibilities for you. If you were a stream winner before, which is quite likely if you do jhanas a lot, if you were a stream winner before and you die in the jhanas, then you go to the jhana realm and you never come back from there. When the jhana realm fades out, you're fully enlightened. You're parinibbana. And that's a lovely way, it's a very neat way to end samsara. Go out with bliss, with a few eons of bliss in the jhana. If that doesn't happen, if you're not a stream winner and you enter jhana and you die, then when you get reborn again, someone asked me this question last night, when you get reborn again, you've got just an incredibly powerful, beautiful mind. You just come out of jhana. The chances are, the way I would see it, and if I was a betting monk, I haven't got any money, but I would say you probably get reborn in the higher deva realms, probably the Brahmakayika devas. If not that, just the higher deva realms, first of all. And then maybe afterwards you come back to human life. You do need that halfway house. It's just too hard to come back to the human realm after you've been so high. And then when you do come back to the human realm after time in the deva realms, then you have such a powerful mind, you're inclined towards the jhanas again. Because these are inclinations imprinted in your mind. And then you get into jhanas again, you probably do it properly in that next life and become at least a stream winner, if not enlightened. So the idea of someone who gets into jhanas, and as soon as the jhanas are finished, you go back into the lower realms, that makes absolutely no sense to me at all. Just can't see it happening. So you don't lose anything by getting into jhanas, but you're increasing your prospect of enlightenment by so many percent. So if there are any questions, we have the box here, because now we have to have the interview times. And usually when it comes to the last couple of days, people say, well, there's only a couple of days to go, I better get my interview now. So it usually gets very busy in the last couple of days. So let's not waste any more time. Interviews are open now. And those of you who don't want interviews, sit. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And be careful of that will trying to sort of decide to push you. Only the last day, I have to really do it now. Come on, that's will, that's not wisdom. Be careful of making that mistake. Carry on as if it's the first day of the retreat or the third day of the retreat. Be timeless. Follow the instructions, just be content, happy to be here. And that is the fastest way. Thank you.